This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. When most people hear the word drone in the context of military applications, the iconic image of the Predator unmanned aerial vehicle probably comes to mind. A silver-winged aircraft with a distinctive bubble in the front. It's been featured in news broadcasts, television, and movies for over a decade now. It's unlikely we'll be seeing any less of them as we go forward. According to the Air Force Chief of Staff, the U.S. is currently training more drone pilots than traditional aircraft pilots. But the Predator drone is no longer the only unmanned military vehicle being employed by the military. Aside from a number of other flying varieties, there are land-based, sea-based, even a secretive space-based drone currently in operation. Not to mention work being done on developing micro-drones. Seems like something that might be useful in the spy trade. So what does all this mean for the future of warfare? We've seen the consequences when bad intelligence or operator error and the power of drones are combined. As recently as a few weeks back, we learned of two Americans being killed in a drone strike in January. And this after several speeches that President Barack Obama has given on the importance of using this technology responsibly.
The United States has taken lethal, targeted action against Al-Qaeda and its associated forces, including with remotely piloted aircraft commonly referred to as drones. And before any strike is taken, there must be near certainty that no civilians will be killed or injured. The highest standard we can set.
That was Obama speaking in 2013, mentioning the importance of setting high standards when using drones. Now, with even more in operation, what kind of concerns should we have? Comment on our website, WNPR.org/where we live. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. What questions and thoughts do you have about the use of drones in warfare? We'll be talking later in the program about some more domestic drone uses. I want to welcome into our studio Alfred Gates, who's a professor in the College of Engineering at Central Connecticut State University. His research has included the development of several unmanned aircraft systems for the Army, the Air Force, and for NASA. Alfred Gates, welcome to Where We Live.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Also joining us by phone is John Kegg. He is an assistant professor of philosophy at the University of Massachusetts Lowell, where he directs the Global Studies PhD program. He's co-author of Drone Warfare, War and Conflict in the Modern World. John, welcome to our show.
Thanks for having me.
And also with us on the phone from South Carolina today is David Axe. He's a writer and journalist focusing on war and technology. He writes for a website called War is Boring. He's the co-author of Warbots, How U.S. Military Robots Are Transforming War in Iraq, Afghanistan, and the Future. David, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
We talked off the top, David, about the drone context that most of us understand today, but drones in one form or other have been in use since World War I. Can you maybe give us a little bit of a history of drones in warfare?
Sure. In World War I, the drones were in development but didn't actually see combat. That would have to wait until World War II. But drones are older than most people realize. That's assuming that we're all agreeing on the definition of a drone, which I would define as a machine that's either autonomous or remotely controlled, or a combination of those two things that can physically affect its surroundings. So by that definition, a guided or an autonomous munition would count as a drone. And in World War I, those were already in development: radio controlled bombs, remote controlled or self propelled guided munitions were already in development. And in World War II, they saw action. Actually, the Germans, the Americans, and the Japanese all had drone munitions ready for combat by 1945.
The Predator drone that we talk about today and that we see in use today isn't itself a particularly new thing. This is based on a design that's been around for decades.
Right. The Predator drone has origins stretching back to the 1980s. And finally entered service with the United States, with the Air Force and the CIA in the mid-1990s. So, it's a 30-year-old technology, and the sort of component technologies are, of course, much older than that.
We're going to be talking about other drones other than the ones that fly overhead, but how much further, David, has the technology come from those days? Obviously, it's built on some of the same platforms as have been around since the 1980s, but are Predator drones enormously more complicated than things that came before, or do we have different sorts of airborne drones that are much, much more complicated than the Predator?
Remote control hasn't changed much. It's basically sending a radio signal from the ground to the air or to the ground, to the sea. Anyways, a radio signal from your operator to your machine that activates servos that steers the device. And the machine itself, ideally will have some way of seeing the world and telling its operator what it sees. Again, you can transmit that information, a television signal, basically by radio. That's a fairly simple technology that hasn't changed a great deal. We did add satellite transmission so that you can move the command signal and then video or other information back from the drone globally, so you don't need to be within line of sight of the drone in order to operate the drone, which is how we can have Predator operators sitting in Nevada steering a Predator drone in Afghanistan or Iraq. So we've added that just in the past 15, 20 years. But the big change in drones lately has been the degree of autonomy, so that drones are now smarter and do more of their own thinking and deciding. That's because of our computer technology and our software is improving very quickly. So something as simple as radio, that doesn't change that much. But as our computers get smarter, our drones get smarter.
So autonomy is something that we'll be getting into a bit more as we talk more of the ethics of drone warfare. I guess one thing I'll just ask you, John Kaag, is the transformation that drones in the military have undergone over the decades. The big leap really isn't so much about technology. It's about whether or not these are used for surveillance or whether they're used to kill people. I mean, there is a very distinct difference in how we might use a drone, whether we're trying to take pictures of something that we might bomb later, or whether we're going to use this thing as the actual bomb-carrying device itself.
That's correct. I mean, as David said, drones have been used for a long time with surveillance as well. And my concern when it comes to the ethics of drone warfare isn't necessarily with surveillance in an international setting, but rather lethal use of drones, and more specifically, the move toward lethal autonomy with drones. I think we're a long way off when it comes to the point of lethal autonomy. But my friend Pat Lynn from The Atlantic recently observed, our cell phones have more computing power than the Apollo rockets that blasted off to the moon. So there's every reason to think that technological advancement will, over the next 50 years, move us quickly in the direction of autonomous devices. So we need to get our thinking, at least our moral and legal thinking, ahead of this trend, I think.
Alfred Gates, maybe you can jump in and talk a bit about these technological improvements that you've seen over time. As we hear about the cell phone that is more powerful than the supercomputer of the 1960s, this is obviously something that we've all seen, these huge technological leaps. Can you talk about the development of technologies in the world that you inhabit around drone development?
Sure. The development of drones has caught everyone off guard. It's a rapidly changing technology, and that's primarily due to the internet, where open source software, autopilot software, is available to the public. And this software is more powerful, more robust than a lot of software, autopilot software, that's available to or that's programmed by aerospace companies and universities. And there's thousands of users. And instead of going to the bar, users are more into updating and making the software even better. And that's how Central made it onto the map of unmanned aircraft, is by utilizing this software. And unfortunately, this software is open to anyone. And then also hardware, electronics. That's another thing that's changed in the past 10 years, is that rather than working in a vacuum, people work together in forums, chat rooms, blogs, etc., on developing this, these electronics, these autopilot electronics. So I would believe that autonomous warfare would be capable probably within the next 5 to 10 years due to the rapid change of the technology. Now, you look back into the 80s when personal computers were developed, and basically people were working in a vacuum. They didn't have a medium to communicate with each other. Now look at unmanned aircraft, and people do have a medium to communicate, and that has drastically changed the growth of the technology. And you could just look at the FAA and the states. Everyone is caught off guard on how this technology evolves so quickly. And just another note, we're at the beginning of the drone capabilities or unmanned aircraft capabilities. When the FAA legalizes drone operations, in other words, you can take a test and become a legal commercial operator, which should happen in 2016-2017 timeframe. That's going to cause another drastic change to how unmanned aircraft is used.
So, and there's a lot in your answer just now that I want to get to. I also want to quickly get to a phone caller, Dan in Springfield, who wants to join us. Hi, Dan. Go ahead. What's your thought?
I'm just curious why there's such a disparity between whether or not an armed drone shoots a missile or a bomb compared to a fighter, when usually the rules of engagement are the same, but society kind of really views them completely different. I just don't understand why, when you're shooting a bomb or a rocket or whatever, there's going to be some collateral damage. It's not like we have something so smart that it's going to kill one specific person. But if we have the rules of engagement, that we have the intelligence, you know, we have some sort of eyes on target, why is it such a disparity between using a UAV compared to a fighter?
Dan, it's a great question, and it's one of the central questions of our conversation. I'll give you the first crack, John Keg.
Sure thing. So thanks for the question, Dan. I mean, I think the real reason has to do with the fact that UAVs lower the cost of warfare in a certain way and lower the flesh in the game that U.S. soldiers have in any particular military attack. So I think one of the dangers is that we use these drones more indiscriminately than we would fighter capabilities. And so that's I think that's the primary concern, and that's a concern that we've discussed in terms of the moral hazard of drones, which I'm sure we'll get to later in the program.
So the cost is a lot less in a lot of different ways. That's one answer. David Axe, what's your thought?
My first thought is that the cost is not less. Drone operations are extremely expensive. The cost in American lives of drone warfare, potentially a lot lower, but I'm not sure it's a lot lower than maybe a ground occupation, but not a lot lower than a traditional air campaign with manned aircraft. I think the caller is absolutely right there, or in his implication, that there is no difference, or very little difference between sending an unmanned, remotely controlled aircraft to bomb your enemies, suspected enemies, and sending a traditional manned warplane. The technology is very similar. The processes are pretty similar. The effects are pretty similar, and the screw-ups are pretty similar.
Mm.
I think that drones come with an aura of ignorance. There's an aura of ignorance and fear around this idea of drone warfare, that the technology and the practices surrounding this technology don't warrant. And we make the same and as bad mistakes with our F-15s and our F-16s as we do with our drones.
Okay, Alfred Gates, I'll give you a chance at this.
I believe that the public is worried about the fact that the drones are making the decisions rather than pilots are making the decision. And as far as I know, pilots are making the decisions right now, and they're not basing their decisions on, or they're not allowing the unmanned aircraft to make the decisions whether to bomb or not via their sensor input.
So one of the things you're essentially implying, Alfred, is that if an American pilot in Nevada is piloting a drone that is flying in Pakistan and they clearly screw up, as was said earlier, and bomb the wrong target or kill someone that they shouldn't have killed, that's a screw-up, but it's a screw-up that, for whatever reason, we can theoretically live with. The leap that you're making is one in which the drone's flying itself, makes a decision, and that screw-up is more costly. Is that what I hear you saying?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying, but we're not at that level right now. Right now, the screw-up is based upon human error, where the chain of command or intelligence was incorrect, and a pilot executes a bomb dropping.
But John Kaag, it sounds as though we're not that far away. If indeed autonomous warfare using drones is something that's within a few years, this is a pretty big question. I mean, we want to get to the question of moral hazard amongst the pilots who fly the drones from Nevada. But if we're going to leap ahead for a moment, what sort of moral hazard is there for a president of the United States putting a drone army making its own decisions in the sky?
Well, there are several concerns that I have. One is what I think we've seen over the last 10 years with the global war on terror is that as our weaponry has become more precise, there have been occasions where our targeting practices have become more vague. So, for example, the idea of a covered person or what is considered to be an enemy combatant has become increasingly vague as our technology has become more precise. And I don't think that that's a coincidence. I think that, in fact, there's a fairly tight relationship between the precision that we use to target certain individuals or certain groups of individuals and the very ambiguous or vague ways that we use to describe these individuals. So that's a concern that I have. And it would hold whether it was with precision-guided munitions, launched from manned aircraft or from ground, or drones. What I do think is interesting and needs to be addressed is why has there been this shift to drones if they are as cost-effective as manned aircraft? And I think that's something that we need to face. Would there be the number of sorties launched in the last 10 years, especially through 2010, 2012, in the tribal regions, in the Middle East generally? So would there have been the same type of military actions taken if they were manned aircraft? I'm not sure, and I think that's something that experts need to address.
And David Axe, could you just quickly address that? Because I really, if we talk about the cost, there's the cost in terms of dollars, but then there's the cost in terms of American lives lost, and that might be a very good reason why we fly more drone missions than actual pilots in that region.
Sure, there's a lot to unpack here. And first of all, we don't necessarily fly more drone missions. You have to break that down and make a comparison of sorties versus sortie length. So, for starters, the advantage of drones, of aerial drones at present, right now, is that they can fly longer missions than manned aircraft can in most cases because you don't have a human being on board the drone. And so the human being doesn't limit the drone's endurance. A person needs to sleep and eat and use the restroom, and they can't do that in most airplanes. So, although in some you actually can, but the bigger ones. So drones can fly, you know, a day at a time in some cases, or 12 hours easily. And so that is the major advantage of a drone aircraft compared to a manned aircraft, but they're not cheaper to operate. Drones have enormous manpower requirements in terms of operators, sensor analysts, the people who actually launch and land them, which raises another point. When you operate drones in a conflict zone, that does not mean there are no Americans in or near the conflict zone, because someone must launch and land those drones in that country or nearby. So wherever you have drone operations very nearby, you also have a drone base that's either manned by U.S. military personnel or American contractors. There are still Americans in harm's way. They're just not sitting inside the aircraft. So another point I would like to raise is that technology doesn't advance in a straight line and certainly not an exponential curve. And many times we develop technology and then pull back from it. By one measure, drone warfare peaked decades ago and is declining. And by that, the measure that I'm asserting is mines. Mines are, in a sense, drone weapons. A mine is a buried or submerged explosive. Some of them can move. Most of them are stationary. But all of them sense their environment and make an autonomous decision to explode or not to explode, depending on what they sense around them, a tank, an enemy soldier, or any soldier, or any person at all, or a ship or a submarine. And mines, for all of their autonomy and increasing sophistication over the years, are fairly imprecise, as a lot of weaponry is. the world grew pretty uncomfortable with these autonomous submerged or buried drone munitions. And I would argue that mine warfare has become, in most cases, less acceptable and less common. There have been a number of international accords that have tried to limit mine warfare, and many countries have banned the use of ground mines, at least. Sea mines is a slightly different question. And so, I don't know, in a sense, that form of autonomous drone warfare had actually peaked and is currently declining and could even become extinct.
We're talking with David Axe, who's the co-author of War Bots, How U.S. Military Robots Are Transforming War in Iraq, Afghanistan, and the Future. He joins us from South Carolina today. Joining us from UMass Lowell in Massachusetts is John Keg. He's an assistant professor of philosophy who's co-author of Drone Warfare, War and Conflict in the Modern World. In studio with us is professor of engineering at Central Connecticut State University, Alfred Gates, who has developed drones. When we come back, we'll take more of your calls and questions. We'll talk more about the ethics of drone warfare and talk about new drones that are on land, in the sea, and in space. That's coming up next, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today in the program, we're talking about drone technology, how far it's come, drones in warfare, but also later on the program, we'll also be talking about domestic drone technology. A quick question from Alan in New Britain. Hi, Alan.
Hey, how are you?
Good. What's up?
Hey, I had a question about the term drone itself, if that's a technical term or if it's a media-driven term.
Well, it's a good question, and we just had a definition given by David Axe of drones used in warfare, the mine that senses its surroundings and blows up something that has been used for a lot longer than some of these other drones we're talking about. Alfred Gates, maybe you could speak to that. I mean, are we using the right technology or the right terminology when we're talking about drones today?
In the past, drones have been considered to be targets for military pilots. The proper terminology is unmanned aircraft, unmanned aerial vehicle, or unmanned aircraft systems, which the FAA uses. That would be the proper terminology. Drone has a negative connotation, and we're going to see some really neat things happen in the commercial usage of unmanned aircraft technology, and we'll see that in the 2016-2017 time frame when the public will be able to apply for operator licenses. There are already commercial operators in the United States. They can get a commercial license for their company through a Section 333 exemption from the FAA. And then also for research, universities and municipalities can operate drones through a certification of authorization, which is another process that you deal with the FAA in the application process.
In your answer, you mentioned that the drone has the word drone has a negative connotation, yeah. But you use it frequently yourself.
I use it, but that's because you're using it on the show.
I'm just wondering.
typically, yeah. I refer to refer to drones as unmanned aircraft or unmanned aircraft systems in other presentations.
John Keg, I mean, from your standpoint, is what we call it? I mean, does this matter?
I think the rhetoric around drones matter a great deal. So, I mean, the way that we talk about whether drones themselves limit collateral damage or the pilots behind drones limit collateral damage. I think the media has a lot of responsibility for making sure that we say that pilots limit collateral damage, not drones necessarily, or precision-guided munitions for that matter. I think it matters.
As we hear, John Keg, about the Air Force training more drone pilots than actual aircraft pilots these days, what do you think the long-term impact of that is? I mean, we've talked a little bit about targeting and the new technology, but you've mentioned the term moral hazard, what it means to fly an unmanned vehicle from thousands of miles away and not have to be near the thing that you're targeting. What does this mean for the people who are involved?
Sure. Well, moral hazard has a pretty specific meaning in philosophy and economics. It's a situation where a party or an individual who doesn't have to face the consequences of their actions have more of a chance and are more inclined to take on either risky or morally problematic behaviors. And it's not so clear to me that the drone operator themselves actually face this type of moral hazard, but our leaders and our military strategists definitely do. So, for example, and David and I were chatting about this earlier in the program, the question is, do our leaders feel more at ease using particular military strategies if those strategies don't either have a direct impact on soldiers or the U.S. public in this case? And this case goes for long-range ballistic missiles and for aerial bombardment and for drones. So that's one issue. But you asked about some of the implications of the U.S. military placing more funds into drones. And I think that there are several issues. One, I think we're going to be facing a sort of arms race issue with drones in the next 10 years, and we're already facing it. So that's something we have to consider. The technologies that we introduce in the next 3 to 4 years will then be will define the terms of drone warfare for the next 10 years. And we need to think ahead a little bit about the precedents that we're setting with the use of these technologies.
Well, before we get to some of the new technologies in a moment, I do want to ask you one last question on this. The idea, John, that the soldier goes into war in a place like Afghanistan and you're on the ground and you're having to deal with very tense situations. We've heard now for years the impact of this on these soldiers as they come home, post-traumatic stress disorder, etc. What do we know about the psychological impact of those who pilot drones who take part in a drone program who, again, are killing people at the end of the day, but in a very different way than those on the ground with a rifle?
That's a great question. So, I mean, Kent McDonald co-authored a Pentagon report on the psychological effects suffered by drone operators. And he says that, and the report says that nearly 30% of them go through what he defines as an existential crisis, which is a fairly sophisticated way for a DOD report to describe these psychological effects. And it's philosophically accurate. So this existential crisis plays out in a very unique way, where these drone operators have the responsibility for attacks that occur half a world away, in a way that a warfighter on the ground does as well. But they, being in Arizona, for example, they actually have a certain leisure or a certain protection from immediate harm, which many warfighters don't face. So that's one issue. The second issue, I think, when it comes to drone operators, we need to remember is that these drone operators are part of a larger armed force. And we have to think about the way that they are addressed within the armed forces. And I've encountered several drone operators who've made the claim that they are, in fact, marginalized within the armed forces. They're not taken seriously. For many years, they weren't regarded as being eligible for certain types of military awards. And I think we have to be very careful about the way that we treat these individuals within the armed forces.
David Axe, I'd like to ask you about some of the other technologies. We've talked an awful lot about aerial drones because they're in the news today and it's what we know the most about. What can you tell us about new developments in land drones, sea drones, maybe even space drones?
Well, the military and private industry are working on all of those things. The problem with drones is primarily one of control. There are very few fully autonomous drones for technological and policy reasons. So almost all drones require some degree of connection to their operator, and that requires a signal to transmit between the operator and the drone. So the air is a great medium for transmitting a radio signal. So aerial drones, there's so much potential there for developing these because you can solve the command problem fairly easily. You either beam a radio signal directly to the aircraft from the ground or you bounce it off the satellite. With ground robots, it's a bit more complicated. Things like hills and trees get in the way. You can get over hills via a satellite or some other kind of retransmission, but trees and foliage and cows and farmhouses and things like that. The ground is a very cluttered environment for a drone. It's difficult to transmit a signal over long distance. Equally, if you build the drone to be highly autonomous, at least in terms of moving around, you still have all that stuff on the ground to contend with. So the ground is a very, very difficult medium for drones. It's not to say that people aren't working on ground robots, and there are many of them in military service, but they tend to be either literally physically connected to their operator via a cable, or they're operated by someone standing nearby with a giant handheld controller, much like a radio-controlled toy. So ground development, you know, we'll see that advance, but it's going to take a lot more work in terms of mobility and control. Now, you can apply a lot of the same problems to surface sea-based unmanned vehicles, unmanned boats, basically. Same problems, right? But when you go underwater, your problems compound significantly. So we are working on unmanned underwater vehicles, but moving a radio signal through water is very difficult. It's not impossible, but it's difficult to do with the kind of, you know, fidelity that you need to operate a remote-controlled robot, which means if you are going to use robots underwater, you need to either physically connect them to your controller via a cable, which limits how far and where that robot can go, or you need the robot to periodically pop up to the surface, stick a radio antenna up in the air, and reconnect with its operator. But then you still have long periods of time where the robot's on its own. That requires autonomy. So you're going to see the undersea robots develop most slowly because they require the most autonomy, which raises technological and policy questions.
And Alfred, you've worked on torpedo drones before, right?
Yeah, that's correct. I worked on the power systems for the MK-48 torpedo, where as a consultant for fuel cell energy, we integrated a solid oxide fuel cell into the MK-48, further extending its power cycle time. And what that allows is submarines to deploy the torpedo and then basically get out of the way, because when you deploy a torpedo, that causes an acoustic signature, which is detectable. So the submarine would deploy the torpedo, get out of the area, and then the torpedo would loiter and wait for its target. After a period of time, it would obviously go for its target.
And does this system that you've worked on, does it have some of the problems that David was talking about of how you actually get a signal to the thing?
Well, that's all set before the torpedo is launched. Once it's launched, it's acting fully autonomously in terms of looking for its target and loitering.
Russell's calling from East Hampton. Hi, Russell. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Yes. My thoughts were starting to drift into the future. I'm sending a drone toward you. Now, you're going to send up your defensive drone, and pretty soon we're going to have little drone dogfights. And I'm wondering if at some point, to take this to an absurd level, maybe someday we have drone-on-drone combat and people don't have to die at all. We can have these big transformer battles. And the winner is whoever ends up with the most drones still alive after the battle's over.
Well, you present an interesting idea. You're not actually sending a drone at us right now, right? Right, Russell?
That's, no, I am
okay,
not.
Good. Okay, I just wanted to make sure. I wasn't entirely sure. Thank you very much for your phone call. It gets at the last thing that we wanted to talk about. And I don't know, John, I'll ask you to weigh in on this first. I mean, what our caller is essentially suggesting is, do we have down the road, whether it's through the continued development of autonomous systems and robotics and even the some of the ways in which we're beginning to deal with the moral and ethical dilemmas around this, do we eventually end up with a future in which our robots are fighting their robots?
I think that's very, very far down the road. I mean, I think what we're going to see in the next years or in the future of war fighting will be a situation in which drones are coupled with manned aircraft, for example, when we're talking about aerial warfare. So, for example, the issue of swarm technology. Swarm technology, initially, we take a bunch of micro drones and we coordinate them to accomplish certain tasks. Initially, the idea was that these would be able to function semi-autonomously or autonomously to accomplish certain tasks or the same sort of missions. But it turns out that the technology is cost prohibitive. But what you do see, and DARPA just came out with this last month, a proposal to sort of hinge swarm technology with manned aircraft. So a situation would be something like this, where a manned F-35 encounters ground defenses or anti-aircraft defenses. And at that point, the pilot, he or she, would call in these very cheap drones, and they would be deployed from a C-130, a sort of drone mothership. And then these drones would go toward the air defenses and signal data back to the fighter, the fighter pilot, for example, but then also try to scramble the air defenses. So we're going to see the coordination of machines, semi-autonomous and autonomous, and manned aircraft or men and women on the ground. And we see the same thing when it comes to biologically enhanced warfighters. What we see is we're going to see in the next 10 years, and we've already seen the development of bionic soldiers and the idea of grafting or sort of having exoskeletons, for example, mechanical exoskeletons on warfighters. And these present ethical and psychological issues for warfighters and strategists.
Before we run out of time, and David Axe, we just have a moment left. The future piece of this I'd like to ask you about is this X-37B orbital test vehicle, a space drone. What's it doing?
We don't know exactly. It's a tiny little Air Force space shuttle with no people on board. It can spend a year or more in orbit, which is 10 times longer than the space shuttle ever could, which is the big advantage of this X-37B. The Air Force doesn't say much about what it's doing up there. The official mission is conducting experiments, but we don't really know what experiments those might be. But in theory, with this tiny, high-endurance, robotic space shuttle, you can do all sorts of things. You can inspect satellites. You can spy on the Earth. And sure, you can even conduct experiments.
And I'm sure you can do a whole lot of things that we won't find out about for years and years that they're doing. David Axe is a writer and a journalist. He edits War is Boring, a website about these issues. The author of War Bots, How the U.S. Military Robots Are Transforming War in Iraq, Afghanistan, and the Future. David, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Thanks also to John Keg, who's an assistant professor of philosophy at UMass Lowell. He is the co-author of Drone Warfare, War and Conflict in the Modern World. Thank you, John.
Thanks so much.
When we come back, we'll take a closer look at the future of drone development and what it means for Connecticut. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, according to a 2014 Nielsen report, jazz is now one of the least consumed music genres in America. As a jazz fan, I say that just can't be. On the next Where We Live, we will have experts and musicians weigh in. Is jazz really in trouble? Is it poised for a big comeback? We're going to find out on the next Where We Live. Hope you can join us. Today, we're talking about the implications of the military's increasing use of drones on the battlefield. It's not the only place this technology is having an impact, though. It's happening here in Connecticut. Our guest in studio is Alfred Gates, a professor in the College of Engineering at Central Connecticut State University. He's developed drones and drone systems. We're talking about their use in warfare. But we're also going to talk about the broader implications of drone technology, how quickly they're developed, and what it means for a university like CCSU that has gotten into the forefront of this new technology.
Well, I can discuss how we did that. In 2006, we decided to take a look at unmanned aircraft technology, but it was a challenge to get up to speed with the big universities. And so we utilized the internet for our research, and that was obviously to our advantage. And we realized that there's open source software available for autopilot systems. And then, and this software, like I said earlier in the program, was far superior than some of the universities that do research in unmanned aircraft, and also some aerospace companies. In fact, many aerospace companies use this software. Another thing that we realized is that the electronics available from the internet, now we're talking from all over the world, is amazing and is far superior than a lot of universities that they make. And we were literally buying electronics from people making them in their garages. In fact, one source, we had to wait for him to get 50 orders, which took several months, but then he would make his 50 autopilots, and we got a couple of them. Then finally, we realized that we needed to have a throwaway aircraft. Back in 2006 to 2010 time frame, other universities were making these incredibly looking and sophisticated aircraft made out of composites, carbon fiber, balsa wood, plywood, etc. However, when you crash them, it takes hundreds of hours to fix them. So we developed a $5 throwaway aircraft made from building insulation from Home Depot, and that could be repaired in 5 to 15 minutes in the field. So that meant that we were racking up hours of autonomous flight testing, situational awareness, recovery from unusual attitudes, while the other universities were repairing their aircraft.
I just have to stop you. Earlier this week, I had a conversation with David McCullough, the historian, who just wrote a book about the Wright brothers and about what they had to do to build a plane that would fly. And just hearing you talk about the fact that now at a small university in Connecticut that doesn't have this long and storied history of development of these technologies, you're able to go to Home Depot and make a cheap aircraft to fly. And you're able to buy electronics and software from this global hive mind of all these people in their basements and garages doing it. That's an amazing, remarkable change. Of all the things we've talked about today, to me, that sounds like one of the most groundbreaking things.
Yeah, it really was, because at some conferences that I made presentations at, they had no idea who Central Connecticut State University is, and the fact that our projects outperformed their projects at the conferences. And again, it was this new way of looking at research. In fact, some of the bigger universities are at a disadvantage because they're stuck in the old mindset that they need to use their software and their electronics to further their technology, which in this new age of the internet, that's not the case.
Well, I'm going to break in just because we have a couple minutes left, and this is a fascinating conversation, but I want to get to a few things that drones can do for us here. We've had a lot of conversations about the ethics of using drones to spy on people or to kill people overseas, but you're talking about applications around fixing and monitoring cell towers or high-tension lines, wildlife management stuff. As a matter of fact, we got a tweet from Neil that says, drones for the environment, catching poachers, early forest fire detection, search and rescue for hikers, monitoring of environmental quality issues. These are all things that are applications you're using right now.
Absolutely. And you'll see more and more of these applications. As I referred to the FAA, once the FAA comes out with the guidelines to license pilots, we'll see more and more of these applications. A big one that we're working on is power line inspection. We're validating this technology. And another note, Central Connecticut State University is the first university in the United States to get authorization from the FAA to fly unmanned aircraft within feet of high-tension power lines. And since then, we've logged over 200 flights. Other areas that you're going to see a big change is real estate. Unmanned aircraft will be used to video the perimeter of houses and the neighborhoods that they reside in. This will be for residential and commercial applications. And then also the news gathering, unmanned aircraft will be used for that. In fact, the FAA approved CNN yesterday to start experimenting with unmanned aircraft.
Well, and this, of course, brings with it a whole series of other issues. There's some legislation actually surrounding drones at the state capitol right now. And some of the questions are, how might police and law enforcement use drones? Do you need a warrant to fly a drone inside my house or to look in my window? If you have a whole bunch of people with different ideas about how to fly drones, what are the rules of a drone flying over my house and my property? These are all things that I'm assuming, Alfred, the legal system is going to have to grapple with, but it's probably going to be pretty messy as we do.
Yeah, this is true, and I encourage the state legislation to be proactive in this area. They need to develop a task force, which is on the floor in terms of they're going to decide whether this should be done. But this task force needs to look at what other states are doing and also what the FAA is doing, and they need to take a conservative approach to using unmanned aircraft because, unfortunately, there are some operators that use them, and they fully don't know the capabilities of the unmanned aircraft, and occasionally they get a flyaway situation where the unmanned aircraft literally flies away from the operator. In addition, the unmanned aircraft, you can put whatever kind of camera on them that you want. There's a local company called Pinnacle X that can modify cameras so that they can be remotely controlled from a distance of approximately a half a mile away. And these cameras can be put on the aircraft. So let's say you want a 20 megapixel or a 30 megapixel camera. This company can modify that camera and put it on an unmanned aircraft, and then it can be used. So the state needs to look also at privacy laws, paparazzi laws, etc., because right now, if you're a hobbyist, you can fly your unmanned aircraft, provided it's not near an airport, and I don't have enough time to go into that detail, but you could fly it and spy on others.
Well, and of course, and we don't want that. And I guess a last question, we just have 1 minute left, is, do you think that we will be able to keep up with the legal challenges that you're obviously seeing on the technological side? I mean, you're seeing great leaps and bounds about what you can do as far as what we can put in the sky, but it seems like it's going to be very slow going developing the legal framework within which we can actually operate these things, right?
Yeah, that's correct. And the FAA has taken a conservative approach, and I think that's the way to go because we want to keep the public safe using these aircraft, and they need to be airworthy if they're going to fly in populated areas. And right now, technically, they're not airworthy. And again, I don't have enough time to go into that. So Connecticut needs to take a conservative approach to the privacy laws, et cetera, to make sure that the people's privacy rights aren't infringed upon.
And there is so much more to talk about around the use of drones in law enforcement, et cetera. But we'll have to leave it there. Alfred Gates is a professor in the College of Engineering at Central Connecticut State University, little university that's seemingly making big noises in the world of unmanned aircraft. His research has included the development of several unmanned aircraft systems for the Army, Air Force, and for NASA. Alfred Gates, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me here.
Our program was produced by Josh Naleo, with help from Betsy Kaplan, Lydia Brown, and Tucker Ives. Kyone Wolf is our technical producer, and Heather Brandon is our digital editor. Our executive producer is Katie Talarski. I'm John Dankosky, and this is Where We Live.